It was the BBE Sonic Maximizer plugin. It sounds impressive, like, when you put it on.
So you put on everything?
So I just put on everything, right? Like, yeah.
You know. I want to maximize everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's out here minimizing? Like, Sonic Maximizer. You want the Sonics maxed. It's simple.
We would like to acknowledge that we are on stolen Yuggera and Turrbal lands, and as settlers of colour, we reflect upon the damaging legacy of colonisation. Always was, always will be.
My name is Ni Adepoyebi. I create sound, and that's in sort of any capacity, like across music, through the media, sort of anything that can be heard, I can have something to do with it, particularly in its recorded format. Yeah.
Nice.
That's that's me for creating and facilitating creation of sound by others, if right. That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I'm always interested in folks of migrant background having creative careers modeled to them. In myself, I was lucky to have, my mum was a music teacher, and so that was directly modeled and like working from home and the kind of flexibility around that and, you know, kind of managing clients. And I was sort of like, got to see all that kind of stuff growing up. So it was never, it wasn't the typical migrant or South Asian thing of like, you know, the doctor, lawyer, engineer.
What time are you becoming a doctor?
Yeah, like, exactly. Exactly. So I'm curious, how was that modeled in your household when you were growing up?
Okay, so this is interesting, right? So I didn't, in my immediate family, you know, so my family, sort of my immediate family, we ended up in Australia.
Yeah.
We're Nigeria and Yoruba. Everyone else is in Nigeria, or some of us, some of my extended family moved to other parts of the world as well. But so in Australia growing up, I really just had my immediate family, which wasn't musical, seemingly wasn't overly musical, or arty, I guess. Okay, no, that's not quite true. There was always music.
A few exceptions. Okay.
Yeah, like there was general music.
Right.
Parents were always singing, dancing and stuff, but it wasn't like go and be a musician at all. It was more the kind of more cliche sort of academic, like, you know, excellence is sort of number one priority.
Yeah.
Yeah, there definitely wasn't like a go and be an artist or musician thing. In fact, hilariously, just on the sort of cliche of, you know, your migrant background, sort of academic push, right?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, so my whole family's quite academic. And when I was a kid, my dad, this is like at a really young age, like in primary school, at the end of the school year, or even mid-year, like when you had the sort of six-week holiday or whatever it is, he would buy me like the textbooks for the next year. So like when I'm finishing grade two, he would get me like grade three maths, grade three, like all the stuff, and like make me do it in the Christmas holidays.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah.
So that I was going into a new school year, like having already done all of the work.
Right.
And then, but that got weird because it started like accumulating because I'd be like, then I was a couple of years ahead. So I remember going into, I think I was going into grade four.
Yeah.
And like I had done grade seven maths. What? And I was just like, I got 3 years now until I can do what I just did.
Right. Does that have like some kind of like counterintuitive effect? Like, are you just like really disengaged in class? Like what?
I reckon later on I got like, oh, you know what? Now that you've said that, that's just made me think. I think it might have been later on where probably I got maybe some version of bored, so I just had to find stuff that I found interesting. And possibly that's how I sort of found like sound and music and stuff, because it was just something else.
Right.
I don't know, that's just like, that just clicked when you said that.
Yeah.
So you know, going to have to dig through my mind and be like, is that what happened?
Right, right. This, so like the academic side of your mind was kind of like, oh yeah, this, all this stuff's easy. This school stuff's easy. Like,
yeah, basically.
But this sound thing, let me figure that out. Let me.
Yeah. Like from a young age, like, yeah, I think that's what happened. Now that I'm just unwrapping that now.
Yeah.
Because even going back really early, like before what that story I just told you of getting the textbooks for the next year.
Yeah.
At a mega young age, my parents taught me to read.
Okay.
And I didn't know that was unusual until we had moved from, where were we living? Probably, we lived on Groot Island for a while and moved to Darwin.
Right.
And I remember going to like a new school, you know, it's like the new kid in like grade one or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, the teacher gets out this book that's like the cat sat on the mat.
Yeah.
And all the kids are like, you know, the, and I'm just like, what? What's, this is, I'm reading books here. Like what have you kids been doing for the last 5 years?
Right, right. Okay.
So yeah, anyway.
I feel like I find that in Sri Lanka, in South Asian education yeah. as well, like there's a bit of pressure at those ages, and perhaps in the Western model, they're sort of on the back foot a little yeah. bit about pushing. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I guess going through, we didn't quite have like, you know, modeling or steps to follow to enter the arts.
Hmm.
But I would later find, so I picked up guitar initially, like that was the first probably instrument I started really trying to play.
Right.
And when I was maybe 13, and I just went like, I was practicing a lot, like serious practice. And I noticed like my mom, she didn't say anything. I could tell she had some issue with it. And I didn't really know what it was.
Hmm.
But it wasn't like a like don't play guitar or something. It was more like, you know, just she'd be like, don't you think you've played like, you know, you've been playing that for ages. Like what? And I would just be like, yeah, I've already done my homework. Like what's the
Like
I cruised through that homework. What, you know, what's the issue?
Right.
And then later I found, like around that time, you know, I'd sort of ask other people in my family, oh, what's the deal with this? That actually a lot of my extended family is musicians and everything.
Okay. You know?
And my mom's older brother, when she was young, right, it was kind of at a time in Nigeria where like the concept of being like a professional musician or more like a professional musician who's in a band and touring, and that was sort of newish. And so her brother was doing that, and he kind of maybe departed from the more sensible life of becoming a whatever.
Hmm.
And was just touring and partying, and his life consisted of touring and partying and like,
right.
you know, women and
yeah, yeah, okay.
So
that's what she was saying.
I think she was like, oh no, guitar. Like this is, I'm hearing that sound that my brother used to like. This can't be good.
Right, right. So she's got this pathway programmed in her mind about yeah. what that means for you.
Yeah.
Mm.
But eventually. Yeah, I was never like discouraged from it or anything, but I didn't have a clear model within my family of pursuing that pathway. It was like, you know, I guess, yeah, everyone was sort of academic or became academic or, you know, yeah, and went down more conventional pathways, I guess.
Right.
That said, my siblings have all done lots of different things,
okay,
you know, in creative realms as well.
So, right, right.
Yeah.
Tell me about that family and your journey to Australia. Like at what point was that?
Yeah. So let's see. I know my dad, so my parents got together in Nigeria, and my dad left before my mom, and there's a couple of gaps in the story where I've been meaning to like go back and be like, hang on, what was what was happening at this period of time.
Mm, mm.
Because I believe my dad had been to Australia at some point before moving here.
Right.
Like just briefly.
Yeah.
But
a little scout visit.
Yes. Some recon.
Yeah. my family did that as well. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And eventually sort of, you know, pretty sort of post sort of like, you know, not long post White Australia policy, like, you know, not long after it was possible to sort of move.
Yeah.
Yeah, he moved and then my mom came and joined. And I have one of my siblings is born in Nigeria and then did the rest, you know, then we're sort of born in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting talking, you know, I always love talking to my parents just about, I guess, the early sort of moments, early times.
Hmm.
In that period, because we lived in lots of different places, like mostly regional.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, one day I've got to go and like, you know, write this all down because there's places we lived that I didn't even like remember and know. And, you know, like living in communities, living just super remote.
Yeah.
Before eventually moving to the big city, Darwin.
of all 100,000, 200,000 people, depending on when you were there. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it was pretty tough. Like just that sort of, you know, early period of, I guess, my parents being in Australia. And
yeah. What was the first port of call? Like where did you land?
I think.
Was it all Northern Territory, WA kind of side? Or?
No, I think when my parents like first moved here, I think it may have been New South Wales somewhere.
Hmm.
I know they lived, before I was born, they lived in Wagga for a while.
Hmm.
But I'm not sure if that was the very first place. And there was a bit of New South Wales around and then Northern Territory and then basically.
Right.
Primarily there.
And what decade was this? What time period for context of migration? So you're saying a bit after White Australia policy, so
I think
80s?
Yeah, I think they
70s, 80s?
Very late 70s.
Very late 70s.
I think I'm gonna say like 79.
Right, right.
Or thereabouts. And you know, so not a like you know, I guess the whole thing of moving without sort of a support network.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, of other people who have had your exact sort of journeys as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like that challenge of like being like, all right, okay, a lot of people don't like us. Let's, you know, that's all right. Let's navigate that and, you know, just find, you know, connect with cool people essentially. And
you know,
and there's lots of people that sort of helped my parents out as well.
Right.
You know, just in terms of navigating.
Okay.
Navigating things. Yeah.
Right, right. It's a bit of a pioneer family because when I think of my parents doing their scout, they were going like all of my dad's side and his parents sort of moved within 5 years or so for each other and I think of each other and I think they were able to sponsor each other, that sort of thing.
Mm.
But as opposed to in recent years and decades where regional settlement has been encouraged or mandated for recent migrants.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that being the case back in 70s and 80s. Like what attracted your family to regional areas?
Yeah. Probably I think it would have been whether it was a specific attraction or not, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the early work my dad was doing, like, so when he came, you know, my parents came straight, my dad was actually a mechanic, which is bizarre. Like, he actually became, like, an academic in Australia, but was just a mechanic. And then I think, you know, not long after, was like, for whatever reason, don't really want to do that here.
Yeah.
And his early work was like running, I know on group, he was running like workshops, like teaching basically teenagers, young men, you know, just sort of basically mechanic stuff.
Right, right.
And that became a job. And then that sort of evolved into community work and just, yeah, very, and then into, then it slowly went into government stuff, policy, mostly around remote areas, communities and everything like that.
Right.
And talking to him, he's passed away a few years ago now, but like,
okay,
when I would talk to him about like, you know, that sort of era, he did talk about sort of his kind of, you know, getting to Australia, you know, moving, going around, you know, looking, you know, just whatever, you know, looking through communities and everything, and just being sort of basically, like he would just say, in sort of shock at just how Aboriginal people are treated in Australia.
Mm.
He just said, it's like, this is horrible, like how this country treats its people.
Right.
And just the total kind of, you know, disrespect and just the attitudes, you know, the attitudes towards it and everything. So.
Right. And again, this is the context of late 70s, early 80s or beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that said, looks like that opinion, like, you know,
didn't shift over the following.
It was never like, oh, it's all right now. Like,
yeah.
You know, not at all. It was just always.
Mm.
And I think that drove him professionally, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I would say that's kind of whether there was initially an attraction to regional areas, I'm not sure.
Mm.
In my mom's case, I do know. So, my parents are from a farm, it's a very small place in Nigeria. Like, I always get to double check, is it on Google Maps, you know?
Whoa, that's all.
So I think one point it wasn't, but now it is.
Okay.
But my mom actually moved to Lagos when she was, I think, 9. Uh-huh. And that's sort of a big city.
Yeah.
And I know that since then, she's kind of a bit, you know, she lived there for, yeah, years. But I think she's, after that, she's just like, I'm done with big cities.
Right, right.
Even though no city in Australia has that kind of intensity and density, I can still see even when, you know, she comes here to like visit in Brisbane, I can tell she does prefer, you know, would prefer not to live in a big city.
Mm.
So
mm.
That I imagine was the appeal for her back then.
That's interesting. Though,
just, yeah. Being in places where you can just, you know, just connect with people directly.
Yeah.
In just a sort of simpler, non-big city way.
So it was a pioneer Nigerian migrant family, a pioneer family of multiculturalism in late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning this notion of some kind of understanding of not many people like us.
Yeah.
How was that communicated to you as a kid? And like how, what was it like growing up with that?
I would say in terms of how it was communicated to me, I guess it was never directly communicated, but you always had like things where it's just an omnipresent kind of thing.
Mm.
And then, you know, yeah, things, more sort of acute things happen when like, so, you know, growing up in Dana, I did run into like a good bunch of like very direct full-on racism, not the sort of subtle stuff, more the serious incident type stuff.
Okay.
So in those cases you're like, oh well, yeah, I get it now, like I'm different, you know.
Yeah.
But
are you comfortable sharing and like one of those?
Oh yeah. Let me see. I would say probably one that sticks out is I'm like riding my bike home from school. I used to love riding around.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally as a kid, like, you know, whatever, a bunch of guys just like yell something out or, you know,
right,
just like, go back to it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I didn't even, by the time I was like 10, I was just like, whatever, you know, like, which is pretty messed up in the, you know,
yeah,
in, you know, that a 10-year-old is like, oh, yeah, whatever, just a bunch of racists. Like, yeah. But probably a more extreme case was I'm crossing the road once and there's a car coming, but I've got plenty of time. And the car just, like, speeds up. And I'm like, I'm sort of walking my bike. And long story short, they tried to run me over. And, like, I jumped out of the way of this car. And as they went by, you know, they're yelling all sorts of stuff. And it's like, they would have actually hit me if I didn't jump out of the way.
Wow.
I was probably 12, I reckon. And so, you know, stuff like that, you know, stuff like that definitely happened periodically.
Yeah.
Growing up, I would say frequency of incidents decreased over time. Just as, you know, stuff slowly gets a little bit better. But yeah, so in terms of knowing or, like, you know, having it communicated that you're some sort of outsider or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, those were like the kind of acute reminders, I guess you'd say, but in a non-acute way, it was just like having things where, like, you couldn't relate to certain things, despite, like, we're sort of, I guess, people that are, you know, generations deep in Australia have just certain things that they know. One thing, I always remember this because at the time, it wasn't really funny at the time, but it makes me laugh now, is being in primary school and watching The Castle.
Yeah, okay.
It's like in a, you know, like various, and I remember, like, everyone at the school I was at the time, yeah, like, it wasn't mega diverse.
Yeah.
And so, at least in my class that I had, and
this is Darwin as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just this particular school, and everyone was, like, laughing. Like, it was just, everyone understood what was going on. It was hilarious. And I remember I just did not get, like, any of it at all. I was just like, what is going, like, Dan dug a hole? Like, what is going on?
Right.
But I just didn't have the context for, like, the characters, but for all the other kids, I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got an uncle like that, or,
yeah, you
know,
okay.
It was, like, a funny.
Right.
So that was just, like, I don't know why I remember that, but it was just this hilarious, like, thing where I'm just like, I've got absolutely no idea what's going on here.
Right, right. So the othering was, like, compounded.
Yeah.
Because of the, yeah.
Like, yeah, it's not like anyone did anything in that scenario. It was just this sort of funny, like, you know, like, I don't know, when you eat sort of, when you go to someone's place and eat, like, I don't know, what's a bland meal? Like, and you're just like, what is, I've got no context for this.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, these peas with no kind
right.
of.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you just, like, I don't know what this is. It's a, you know, it's not good or bad. It's just a, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And so if you're 10 and perhaps younger and, like, brushing off, you know, racist things being shouted at you on the road, how much of that are you taking back to your parents if you're already sort of got, like, such a thick jacket of armor on at a young age? Like, do you, can, like, that particular incident, did you take it home to your parents? That you nearly got run down by someone? Like,
I'm not sure. I think I would probably take back, like, half, maybe.
Yeah.
Definitely not everything, but some for sure. Like, if I was in a situation where, like, I didn't know what to do, I guess I'd ask my parents. Yeah, but otherwise, not, yeah, just some here and there, I guess. Yeah. If I didn't feel like if I felt like I needed some advice or something or some help or whatever, then for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But otherwise, yeah.
And do you think it was the protective model migrant and sort of code switching ethos that inspired the, I'm going to get you the maths books for the next year because everyone doubts you and you need to be excellent. Like, is this some of, do you think that's some of the?
Yeah. In loosely.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least I think, and I would have conversations with my parents about that. Because, you know, as a kid, you're just like, why am I doing, like,
yeah,
what? You know.
Everyone else is running around and playing, doing yeah, yeah. whatever.
Michael's not doing it. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Michael gets to go to the show. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would just be like, what's this about? Like,
yeah.
You know, or what's with the, like, sort of sternness of the whole thing? And, like, I and my parents sort of both very different. So it was cool having, like, I guess growing up, I liked having two parents with very different personalities.
Mm.
So I'd go to both of them for advice and, you know, both get a different way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So my dad, who was very direct, no subtlety, no sort of, yeah, just super direct. He was just like, okay, well. And he probably explained this to me at, like, varying levels of complexity as I got older. Like,
okay, yeah.
But eventually he was like, it's fairly simple. You know, your friends who just do whatever and mess around and whatever, when you get a little bit older, you'll find a lot of them, like, there's just a system already in place which will just look after them somehow. Like, you'll just find, you know, your friend who was mucking around in class actually has like seven generations of family wealth and owns a whole bunch of stuff, and it's just not going to matter. So,
wow.
Whereas you, on the other hand, don't have that. So if you want to, like, you just can't afford to sort of do that. And he would tell that to, you know, me and my siblings, I guess, in some. But I guess when I was a little kid, you know, I was like, why am I doing this, like, next year's work? You know, he'd just be like, simple. It's like, oh, because you need to work harder. Yeah, that's the thing you see in lots of sort of migrant families in terms of their approach, which makes sense fundamentally.
Yeah.
You know, how it's delivered can vary.
Mm.
But yeah, I think that was sort of it in my case of how it was explained.
Mm-hmm.
Which sometimes I didn't really understand as a kid, but
yeah.
Like, understanding of it grew, I guess. Yeah. And my dad was always just like, the general system is designed for some people, not necessarily everyone, not necessarily you. So
wow. And so he was distilling these ideas of generational wealth and white supremacy,
yeah,
and inequity,
yeah,
in from a young age.
Wow. Yeah. And he was just like, it's not, it's like, it works great for some because that's who it's designed for.
Mm.
But if you're not quite in that, then you might have to do some other things. And he wasn't really sort of doom and gloom about it either. It was just a very direct, it's just like
practical,
it's just like, this is what it is, right?
Wow.
You know,
right.
And it's kind of just like, that's what I'm doing, like, yeah, it's
right,
kind of the, yeah.
And was it a big family? Did you have many siblings or?
Yeah, so there was, I got, let me see, growing up there was, it's actually funny,
so okay, here it comes.
Initially it was me and three of my sisters.
Okay.
Who are older than me.
Uh-huh.
And an older half-sister moved to Australia when she was early 20s.
Okay.
And joined us.
Right.
So that was cool. And yeah, so there's, how many is that? Like, that's five kids.
Yeah.
In total. Yeah.
Yeah.
And mostly living in, you know, pretty sort of small, like, when I think back to, like, you know, one of the main houses we lived in, I'm just like, that was pretty small.
Yeah.
Like, that was a pretty small house for a whole bunch of people, but yeah.
You know, was it like a classic territory, two-story, louvers kind of tropical house?
It was, yeah, a tropical house. It was one of the one-story, you know, there's like sort of there's maybe sort of five designs up there
right.
for housing.
Right.
It was the kind of one story, reasonable block of like land.
So not raised up.
No. Okay. No, it wasn't one of the stilts ones. It was one of the ground level.
Okay.
You know, louvers everywhere.
Yeah.
They're all, I think it was actually an old housing commission design. It was one of the,
okay.
which a whole bunch of houses are like, you know, they were public housing that got sold. So the designs were sort of like, you know, drag and drop public housing kind of houses.
Mm.
I think prior to that, we lived in public housing. And so it's like, oh, familiar.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So pretty simple.
Right. So with your father distilling these ideas down to you as a kid, and already your mum is concerned about the sound of guitar coming from her, from your bedroom, based on familial journeys with that. Does your dad have the expectation that all this academic performance is going to lead to some kind of academic career? And what is his reflections when it isn't starting to not look like that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's it. Yeah. Okay. So, I think going through school, I remember like probably early-ish, maybe definitely by mid high school, I'm losing interest in the sort of conventional school, like, you know, kind of school stuff. All through life, I always played sport and stuff. Like, I went through a few different sports. By this time, I've, you know, taken up basketball and just loving that, and music as well.
Mm.
And not really being very interested in kind of anything else, really. Like, and I could see my parents start to become concerned.
Mm.
Like, you know, I could, because we'd communicate stuff, like, and you know, I was like, I can tell that to them, they're just like, uh-oh. Like, you know? They're like, but like, oddly, like on the sports side of thing, from a really young age, actually, both my parents pushed that like on me as well, alongside
like a professional pathway towards,
not so much actually pushing, but like from a very young age, they were like, you've actually got to do sport and be physically active.
Mm.
But it wasn't so much a pushy sport parent thing. It was more just, initially it was just like, being physical is important. They didn't necessarily intend, you know, to like super pursue that. But that was always a thing that was like sort of pushed early on. Which, backtracking just to like super early years, it was also a funny thing. Like at the time, I think we moved to Darwin on playing soccer, which was cool because it was also like, you know, a lot of other kids just from, you know, varying migrant backgrounds, and lots of the coaching, like it was one area where like coaching was pretty hardcore, but on like, you know, kids in like under six kind of stuff, like,
wow.
To the point where I'm like looking back, I'm like, yeah, I don't think you can coach kids like that now. Like, I don't think.
Yeah.
Like, okay. I remember doing like actual fitness training as a 5-year-old. Not like have fun. Now it's all like, you know, have fun kids with like.
Wow.
This was like, you know, having like some coach sort of like, you know, moved to Australia from like, you know, Greece or Macedonia. It's just like, like.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
And so on. But it was like, did set up a good foundation for like, you know, looking after yourself physically, I guess. But yeah, jumping back to what we're talking about with, you know, parents seeing, okay, is this kid like not doing the sort of things, especially as most of my older siblings were like, you know, very, very academic, like just like extreme sort of, you know, like where you know, here's the scholarships, like, you know, that kind of level.
Right. Yeah.
So it came to me, it's like, there's this guitar happening, he's just training all the time. And I think, I'm trying to remember some conversations. I remember thinking, oh no, like, they're going to be like angry with me. Or like, I remember getting to a point where I'm thinking, oh, they're probably just like really disappointed and or just unhappy with this apparent pathway that I'm going down. And I remember having this chat with my dad, and that actually like wasn't the case. I was really surprised.
Right.
He was kind of more like, yeah, look, I can see like your interests are developing that are sort of outside of, you know, the sort of normal conventional things, and like maybe not really interested in and in those things.
Right.
And I was just like, yep.
That's correct.
Yeah. And he was just like, yeah, like, look, that's all right. But it was always about like, make sure you've got a few skills across it. Like that was his approach.
Like the fallback options.
Yeah, yeah, essentially.
Should that fail or whatever.
Yeah. He was saying it's important not to just invest 1,000,000% into one skill.
Yeah.
So, you know, play your guitar, but also think, what else can you do? Which he was like, because, you know, what if one day you can't play guitar? Like, what if you get amazing or whatever, but then one day, for whatever reason, you actually just can't do it?
Right, yeah.
And I kind of got looking at his general, like, just knowing that he was a mechanic, moved to Australia. I don't really know if anything specific happened, but I know that at some point, after not long in Australia, he was just like, I don't want to be a mechanic. And went down an entirely different, like, just went down the academic pathway, which, you know, just went to university, just studied. Then was just like, now I have a PhD and
wow,
management, and just, you know, doing stuff that's like, I didn't even know he was a mechanic until I was like 17 or something, like when I'm learning to drive, and he was like, oh, I'll show you how a car works so that you know, in case you break down. And he's just, you know. And he showed me.
Let me bust out this secret career.
Yeah, I've had. And he didn't even tell me. It wasn't like, I used to be a mechanic. I was just thinking, how does he know any of this? What's... Yeah.
This is like how your Nigerian dad tells you he's a mechanic.
Yeah.
It's like when you're learning to drive at age 17.
Yeah.
And you discover he knows every single piece of the car and how to put it back together.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think that was like the rationale behind, you know, saying you've got to have multiple plans or whatever, so that you can do multiple things.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
if you need to.
Which was not so common for that generation, those generations. Like, it's almost commonplace today, but
yeah,
it's like a different, unusual kind of thinking for that time period.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think my mom was just kind of like a similar thing, just more about like, yeah, staying, encouraging me to stay, I guess, balanced, you know, just with other things, and yeah, keep things, you know, have a variety of things going on and interests and whatnot. But on the whole, they weren't sort of like, oh no, our son's not becoming a lawyer or whatever, at all, really. And they ended up being like quite encouraging,
right,
I suppose, of, yeah,
okay,
you know, going down a more creative pathway.
Right. And so growing up in like being academically talented but not engaged in those directions, and then finding a love and a passion and some sort of mystique around sound and music,
yeah,
how did that play out, so to speak, for you? Like, where you picked up a guitar and...
Yeah. Initially, it was... I'm in early high school. Some of my friends are just like, we're learning, they were doing like guitar lessons that the school sort of ran or whatever. I was just like, I don't know, thought like you should check it out or whatever.
Mm.
And I did, you know, they had these like out of tune, like nylon string guitars, like, you know, that every school
classic,
has.
For, yeah.
Like, you can get them for $80 or whatever.
Yeah.
You can't actually tune them properly, you know, whatever.
You know, yeah.
And they showed me how to play, like, I don't even know, something. And I was just like, wow, this is fun. This is great. I'm going to learn how to do this thing.
Hmm.
And so I started learning, was super into it. Broke my arm very badly about 3 weeks into learning guitar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, playing footy.
Oh, right.
And like, I'd been practicing like all that time that happened. I actually was in hospital for like 2 weeks.
Whoa.
Like, totally messed up all the nerves in my hand. Like, had to relearn to use my hand.
Wow.
So I was like, well, that's a bit of a setback
yeah.
in the guitar department.
What age is that?
Considering I can't use my hand. 13.
13. And that's your dominant hand, is it?
It was my left, yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, the...
Yeah, the one you... Yeah.
Picking... No, what, fretting.
Finger, yeah, fretting. Yeah.
Fretting hand, yeah.
So then, I guess... Came back to that after like a year of relearning to use my hand.
Whoa.
And then I was like, cool, this is fun. Enjoying it. Had some, you know, horrible band, like just with my friends.
Yeah.
In school. And very quickly, I would, you know, our band, like any high school band, sucked.
Except, yeah.
Actually, no.
What genre was it? In a rock direction, was it?
Or? Yeah, like it's
yeah.
high school. Like these are boys in high school.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no, you know, no one's talking no. about like.
Yeah.
I think we played, what do we play? I don't even think there were any original songs.
Hmm.
I think it was just covers of like Metallica probably,
yeah.
you know, just whatever.
Yeah.
And I do remember actually there was a band at that school in like the year above us and they had original songs and were good. And we always used to do these gigs where like they would get on, they would be like really awesome. And we would get on and like somehow it just sounded horrible. Like stuff broke, there was feedback. You know, when you don't even know what feedback, you're just like, what, why is this happening? Anyway,
yeah,
but very quickly after playing in this band, for some reason, I just would be in the practice room and I'd be like, okay, aside from like this just sucking as a band, like aside from that,
yeah,
this sounds horrible. And so I would just be like, this is just, I can't handle this. So, you know, I would just learn how to sort of tweak everyone's amps and everything to sound less horrible. Because I, like, for some, whatever, that just affected me more. No, like, my friends didn't seem to care. They were just happy sort of slogging out riffs or whatever.
Right, right.
And I was like, we have to make this sound better. And then that sort of seemed to spread, like, other people who played guitar or whatever, anytime they were playing, they'd be like, hey, you like, they'd call out to me, like, can you help me, like, set this thing up and like, you know,
okay,
adjust the knobs on this amp or
right,
whatever.
Right. Did you do anything to the drums to make it sound better at this stage?
At this stage, no.
More
I was more just like, why are you hitting them so hard? Like, what the, you know, like it's not, it's not
classic
like
classic high school drummer.
It's not better
yeah,
if you hit
yeah.
the hi-hat, you know. It's just worse.
Yeah, yeah.
But even though, like, drums were my first, before I, like, started learning guitar, like, as a younger kid, they were probably the first, drums and percussion, that was the first thing I was interested in sonically.
Right,
where
right.
I would listen to recordings which growing up, despite like, you know, my parents not being actual musicians, although, yeah, actually, no, they do, they, you know, they did sing and stuff, and my mum was in a choir and whatever.
Right.
But we did always have music on and a variety of music, like just from, you know, whatever was popular like here at the day to like, you know, all the music from Nigeria and everything.
Mm.
So that were the first instruments like where I'd listen to them and be like, what is that? How would I recreate it? Mm. Like how would I hit it to make that sound?
Yeah.
But at that point, I didn't really know what to do with like any sort of drums other than, you know, I can still remember the first time hearing an acoustic, like a drum set in real life. Like one of my friends, he got like a, I don't know, PDP or one of those,
yeah,
you know, ultra low end drum sets.
Yeah.
And I was like really excited to sort of hear this thing, you know, which I like at this point, I'm listening to so many recordings and everything. And he starts playing. I'm just like, that sounds nothing like. <you know? laughs> I was like, this is just a horrible, like flabby sound.
Yeah. Sounds nothing like the produced drum kit sounds I'm used to hearing on records.
Yeah. It's like, all I can hear is hi-hat, like just like bashing this thing. Mm. So, you know, slowly, yeah, big, that was where I guess it, I began sort of thinking about sound and trying to make it better. I guess it was born out of being in, you know, just being in the band situation, being like, this sucks, this is horrible.
Yeah.
And then later in high school, starting to like record, I guess, in varying ways. Like I'd changed schools and the next school I went to actually had, there were some people there that played that were fairly good. There was, I guess there was more people. It was a bigger school. There was just more people, you know, who were playing like reasonably good.
Yeah.
And yeah, started thinking more like recording things. I got some software.
Do you remember what was the first?
Yeah. N-Track Studio.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. It was a fully featured, like, multi-track, you know.
Okay.
Like in Reaper or Pro Tools or whatever. Like,
right, right.
You could record and overdub and probably program drums and whatever. So I had that. I also had a little portable recorder that recorded onto cassette.
Mm-hmm.
And had this add-on like stereo mic, which I've still got. It's like
a little plug-in, like T-shaped one.
Yeah, like a little. I think it was a Sony thing.
Yeah,
I don't know how I bought it. Like, anyway.
Yeah. Don't incriminate yourself.
Yeah, I definitely purchased this. It's like I didn't have any money. What? How did I get? Anyway. This is Darwin. This is... Anyway, and I used to take that to parties and stuff and just, like, record, you know, people sort of jamming, like, me and my friends.
Mm.
And, like, listen, you know, listen back to that. And that was sort of fun, particularly because it was, like, a decent stereo mic. Like, the recordings were a fairly good representation of just whatever was in front of them. But then, you know, starting to think, okay, like I was writing music and then you start to think, okay, how can I overdub a second part or whatever? And then the same thought, you know, that I'd have earlier on playing in the bands would be like, I'd do this thing, I've written this song, I'm recorded bits, I'm overdubbing, and I'd be like, wow, that sucks. How can this not suck? Like this sounds so much worse than anything I'm listening to. So
in terms of like production standard, how it's recorded, like that sort of thing, like
yeah, just the sound, everything.
Yeah.
And at this point, like by this time, I've got pretty good technical facility on guitar, at least. Like I'm, for that point, I guess, in this whole thing, I'm a comfortable musician. Like I can play across a number of styles and, you know, have good technique and whatever. But I was just like, this sucks. Like the sound of this is just not there.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, you know, drove, or I say drove, but it's a continual driver.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, trying to push things forward in terms of my own skills with sound, at least. Yeah.
So you're kind of becoming like a guitar and bass tech to your peers in high school there, and then you're starting to record yourself and it's still not quite sounding right. You've already got your guitar and bass friends asking them to come and tweak the settings and whatnot.
Yeah.
At which point do you start recording for other people, or do you just record your own bands and projects for a while?
Let me see. I think wrapping up high school, I'd really just recorded, like, in high school, be like myself and or stuff with friends. And I had like lots of like, you know, because I was interested in, like, I'd always be writing, you know, just random music and stuff as well. So I'd record that. Wasn't a lot of like other people until I think. So after school, I took a year off and was just, what was I doing? Working, playing a lot of, you know, just practicing a whole bunch as well.
Yeah.
And the next year I started university. And that was probably where I started, like, you know, recording other people.
Okay. Right.
I remember, I think the first.
And what's the course there that you're in?
I was doing a Bachelor of Music Technology. Yeah, just down at South Bank in the conservatorium there.
Right.
And that was great for, because, you know, now I've got recording studio access and just making friends with everyone around me who's a musician.
Yeah.
And, you know, wants their stuff recorded for free.
Yeah.
And I could, like, you know, and I was like learning more and more and more, and just trying to get better at it. And outside of university, I'd also like, you know, just record some stuff. I remember probably the first like thing that I recorded that was like a, I guess, an EP or, you know, like a distinct sort of, this is the thing we did.
Yeah.
Oh, so it was actually a guy from in high school, in early high school, when I was in a band. And I was talking about how there was another band at school that was like good. And,
yeah,
then, you know, they'd play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the singer from that band actually, you know, he'd moved down here to Brisbane as well.
Right.
From Darwin.
Okay.
And he was doing like singer-songwritery stuff. And I was living in this share house, Queenslander kind of thing. And so, you know, we recorded a kind of four-track thing then. And it's really funny because we put so many hours into it. Like, you know, he'd come over sort of evenings for like, has to have been months.
Recording in your share house? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Just in my, I think I had, you know, in my bedroom, I just had my PC set up. I had like a Rode NT5. No, I had two Rode NT5s. This is like, I was in the big league.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that was like the vocal mic. It was the, you know, everything was a Rode NT5. Everything got mic'd with that.
Okay.
And into like Cubase. And we arranged it all as well. Like we programmed drums and, you know.
Yeah.
Wrote like I think, probably the worst string parts I'll ever write. I don't know what, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so that was probably the first sort of thing I sort of recorded for someone, like just like an artist being like, I want to record, you know, and like starting from scratch, like here's my songs,
yeah.
just,
yeah.
you know, they don't have any other instruments yet or
hmm.
whatever. And it was every now and then, because I've still got the actual CD, every like few years, I just put it on and listen to it as like a sort of benchmark of like thinking, okay, that's where I was at one point in time. It's not even that bad.
Right.
It's actually just really funny to listen to because I didn't really know much about EQ and whatnot then.
Mm.
Like I was very early learning and I had this one plugin. It was the BBE Sonic Maximizer plugin. And it was one of those, like, as a, it sounds impressive, like, when you put it on.
So you put on
so
everything?
So I just put on everything. Like, you know, I can't remember. It just had, like, two or three knobs.
I want to maximize everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, who doesn't, I mean, why would you not, would like, you not? Who's out here minimizing? Like, Sonic Maximizer. You want the Sonics maxed. It's simple. It had two knobs. It was like, I can't remember. They were like Excite and like, probably, I don't know, Inferno or something. I can't even remember. But that just went on everything.
Nice. Like, yeah.
Vocals, yep. Guitars, yep. You know, violins, yep. And so like listening back to it, it's got this really funny, like ultra bright, weird forward sound.
Right.
But at the same time, it's kind of like, that was a moment in time.
Hmm.
It's like a photo.
Yeah.
A very particular one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of just, that's what I was doing then. So yeah, that was the probably first sort of thing. Then, you know, beginning uni and going through that, I was doing a lot of it. Then I prioritized when I was studying, you know, you had to have, I can't even remember the, you did all these different subjects and you had to have your major study portfolio of recordings.
Mm.
I also did composition and performance electives and whatnot as well. But I prioritized just meeting and talking to people that was studying in the same building that I was and doing a lot of recording. That was my, because you're sort of meant to do like these big projects. And I did do those as well. But I also just made sure I was just recording all the time as much as I could, like anything.
Yeah, just getting points on the board.
Yeah, I just had my hand up for anything.
Mm.
And just made sure I just, you know, spoke to as many people as I could, made as many friends as I could. And just got as much experience out of it. Because I was like, all right, I'm just here. You know, doing a degree for a few years, might as well just, you know, when you, even though there's like hex or help, whatever, you know, when you actually like look at how much a degree costs, sure, you're paying it later.
Yeah.
But I remember like looking at some breakdowns of like how much you're paying per hour or, you know, to study.
Right.
And so I remember just like, I'm getting bang for buck on this.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm using these facilities.
Isn't that a great flipping of the kind of typical uni student ethos, right?
Mm.
Like that is like, maybe it's shifting now with more awareness around it, but like thinking on my time in uni, like I maybe like that at some points, but
yeah,
what a great approach. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember just thinking I'm milking the resources to like, even things like I remember like our library, you know, it was functioning like a conventional library, but there was also just this sort of hidden, like, DVD section. This is, yes, in the era of DVDs.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm not paying that $2 down at Network Video. Yeah, like, I'm getting DVDs.
I used to go in and rip the CDs from the library, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, recording. And then by sort of later in the degree, and I'm also playing and for lots of different things through this whole time as well. And by later in the degree, like, I'm more finding, like, here and there, like, lecturers are asking me to record certain, like, you know, requesting, like, if I can be on a particular project or whatever, or just friends and stuff being like, oh, can we get him to record it?
Mm.
Just from having, you know, doing as much as I could. Yeah, and just having it sort of spill on from there. I guess those years studying were, like, pretty instrumental just in terms of doing so much and also having the time to just practice, like, be it instrumental practice and ear training, lots of just, you know, probably haven't spent as much time ear training, you know, since doing that, really.
Mm, mm.
Yeah.
Even though it's music technology, you still get a fair bit of performance.
Yeah, I elected to, yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. Because I always saw it as, like, there's not a lot of, I think I identified early, like, for working with, it was my opinion, I suppose, working with music. If you're going to be engineering music, it's probably tougher if you can't, or if you're not, if you don't have the facility, like, to sort of deal with the musical side of
yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I, you know, sort of later find that, you know, when you're trying to make good recordings, the number one obstacle to that is, like, I'm just going to be blunt, the number one obstacle I find in most scenarios is that bands suck. That's the, like, not like,
yeah,
not suck, but
you're,
like,
you're, like, trying to find the right plugin, or this sounds not right, yeah, or this mic technique's not right, but it
really,
when it comes down to it,
yeah, it's like, really, it just needed better parts, better chord voicings, better whatever, like, just
right,
better stuff on the musical end,
right?
So I kind of, like, tried to get as much facility, ability, and knowledge as possible with playing, arranging music, music theory, whatever, like, just
right,
all of that.
Right.
Yeah,
so, like, beyond the audio engineer sphere and more into the producer,
yeah,
technically the producer sphere. Yeah.
Because I think that they, like, are sort of inseparable.
Yeah.
They'll both benefit each other. And you can make your job easier if you're engineering, if you can just, you know, nudge things in a musical direction, so you don't have to think, oh, how am I going to EQ this keyboard out of the way, you know, like, of this guitar or whatever, when it simply isn't an issue to begin with, I guess.
Right, right.
Yeah. So that was my, I guess that was a driver in terms of, and I just enjoy, you know, playing music, and, you know, like, I was throwing myself into all different recording situations, but also throwing myself into different bands and just whatever as well.
Right,
for
right,
fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so Knees Tops tips for musicians about to hit the studio or start recording is, number one, don't suck. What are some
that
other
sounds bad. I mean, that's, you know, that sounds like, I think people suck. But people are great.
Like, I guess start with good music, start with good composition, good parts.
Yeah, like, I think the more, like, practice is just awesome. Mm. It just works. Mm. If you can practice, not so much, like, before a specific thing, but just as an ongoing thing, as a, well, as an anything, really.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Like, it really just works, and yeah, practice and learning are just these amazing things. Your brain is just like, all right, cool information.
Yeah.
Now I can do that thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess, yeah, that always makes recording easier, essentially.
Mm.
Yeah. When, and also, and practicing with intent, like, sort of, say, you know, just a hypothetical example. you're a real example. You're a keyboard player.
Mm.
You know, you're practicing. And, you know, most people get to the point where they're good and professional and can really play, but might not have practiced the kinds of things you might need to do in a recording setting, or really thought about that. In terms of like how you fit into a broader picture of a, you know, final sonic product or thing or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Yeah, and just like intently practicing those sorts of things.
Is there merit in doing like a pre-production arrangement in band, in garage band or whatever you can to, so you sort of get your head in that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, that's, yeah, probably.
Because it's so accessible for those levels. And if you're wanting to work with an engineer, you're recognizing that you want to take it a bit further, but it still helps to go through those.
Yeah.
That process and go through those motions.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. It's one thing, like, I'm always encouraging, like, the more of that can be done, the better,
yeah.
I find.
Yeah.
Because you can just hear it back and be like, oh, I didn't realize that actually this, you know, could be better if I just did this way. Mm. There's, and it also helps when, like, I think to not do that, and, you know, there are times where, like, that doesn't, and styles of music where that isn't necessarily what needs to happen. Like, if you're, like, a jazz trio, you're probably not really needing to do sort of a whole bunch of, you know, phases of demoing stuff.
Right, when you have something that's more tracked live.
Yeah.
There's less of...
Yeah, there's an expected sort of sound.
Mm.
You know how to do it.
Yeah.
But for a lot of other things, yeah, the more stages of demo things go through,
yeah,
the better. Like, I've done projects before where before the actual real sessions, there's been a few demos, and like the final demo, I've done stuff where like the final demo is actually pretty good. Like, you wouldn't release it quite, but
yeah,
it's like, oh, that's, we can really hear the finished thing.
Right. Right.
And even taking stuff from that demo into the, like just
pulling. Yeah. Okay. Right. That's almost like in the film world where we pull references and things.
Yeah.
Cause we can get, if we can quickly pull some references together, then we can get that much close, like, you know, 80% close to what that vision is.
Yeah.
And then we can help the client or the project get there. Right. And in a similar fashion, I guess you would also have references or reference mixes.
Yeah.
But beyond that, doing a demo, having all those layers and stems, being able to pull apart parts before you get into the, I guess, costly part of studio time and hiring an engineer,
yeah,
that you've done a lot of groundwork yourself,
yeah,
kind of on your own time,
yeah,
will lead to like a much better product. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like, you know, not doing that can also work as well,
right,
but in a lot, yeah, of scenarios, and particularly now where everyone, well, many people have some access to some sort of recording.
Yeah.
You know, you've got stuff that's free like Reaper and, you, yeah, know, and,
yeah.
Please
use Reaper and not Audacity. Please. Talk to me later.
Valid, yeah.
Use whatever works, but yeah.
And there's, on the extreme end, like I've done some things which are on the extreme end where like I was saying, like things from the demo actually make it. And even things like, one, I've done this a couple of times with things that are guitar-based. Using, you know, virtual amplifiers.
Yeah.
But dialing in a tone, like, you know, dialing in a sound, then in the actual recording, hiring that amplifier and just putting, literally just setting the knobs how I did in the software version.
Oh, so you're yeah, okay.
Because like, I pulled this sound with a digital model of it.
Right.
That's generally it. I'm going to go and hire the real thing. do the same thing.
Okay.
And that has worked very well.
Right. Right.
Now, like in the guitar thing, like a lot of the digital stuff is actually good enough just to use.
Yeah.
For many things.
Yeah.
But like that's, and you can even drum tuning and selection, that can happen. You can just program up a demo and just be like, okay, I'm going to whatever, throw.
Tune it to that.
Yeah. And right. use this kind of drum and be like, okay, that sounds, you can try out different things. This is for like acoustic recordings.
Yeah. Yeah, right,
like that's the extreme end of what you can do, I think, before going to a studio.
Yeah.
Because then you've got a framework and you can still change that. It's not like you're stuck in this box or anything, but it's like then you can still be like, oh, now we've got cool ideas or whatever.
Right. Okay. So we met working in broadcast at a radio station, and I have wanted to come have you here for a chat for a while, but I refused to until I had these microphones matched. and that is because I'm a big fan of like how your voice sounds, and I wanted to capture it and convey it in a certain way. And I was lucky enough to get my hands on one of my dream microphones when I started this podcast, and then recently managed to balance them up.
Nice.
So I have two of these, the Electro Voice RE20s for the tech folks out there.
Yeah.
I am interested in this idea of underrepresented excellence being hidden in plain sight. And black and brown voices perhaps not being received or seen for what they are. Mm. Now, you have worked in broadcast and for several radio stations, not just the one that we work on. What are the kind, like, have producers like pulled you into a room and say, hey, can you read this thing for me? Or have you thought about being a presenter? Or like, what are the kind of like industry responses that you've had to your voice being working in these spaces?
Yeah. Thank you, by the way. Pretty good. And like, I've done lots of voiceover things.
Okay.
Which, you know, initially sort of happened circumstantially.
Right.
Of just, you know, working on radio and voicing like a promo for something.
Yeah.
In a rush, but then it being like, oh, can you actually do the rest of, you know, what, like,
yeah,
like that sort of thing.
Right.
And I enjoy it. I don't, it's something I do like sometimes fairly frequently.
Okay.
Mostly here and there, like, where I, for certain things where I'm like, okay, yeah, my voice would be ideal for that. I'll.
Like projects that you're working on that you.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah. And yeah, sometimes people just request, like, can you do this thing?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Right.
And yeah, I enjoy it, particularly because as an engineer, I can also just do it and deliver like an end product.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like that's not a, you know, what, that's just a fine, easy thing.
Yeah.
And I enjoy just working with the voice generally. Mm-hmm. Like it's whether it's my voice or someone else's voice.
Yeah.
And that's just across voiceovers, singing, whatever. I really just enjoy listening to people's voices and working with them somehow. So
yeah,
generally it's been pretty good in that. Mostly like the stuff I end up doing is you're sort of straight, like, you know, authoritative, like, you know, like male, like,
can you just
information?
Give me a fake example.
Like, I don't know. Like, well, one, okay, a good example. I don't know how this one happened, but there was renovations to one of the train stations in Melbourne. And, you know, buses had replaced trains and like, the, you know, there's a voice that comes out if you go to the train station.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I got the gig as the voice that plays out of the speaker, you know, that's just like Fitzroy Station is, you know, whatever. Like,
come on, you got to give me a bit more than that.
It's undergoing repairs. passengers for Brunswick. There are, you know, buses will replace trains from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. weekdays.
Okay, so these kinds of gigs.
Yeah.
But have you any interest in like being a presenter, or have you guested on shows? Like what about that level of?
I've had people like talk to me about it. And I'm like, I don't know if I can think quickly enough to like sometimes when I, you know, am like working with presenters and just, I mean, I'm not ruling it out, but
even with seeing what we see about how producers work and the scripts and all of that sort of safety net that is there for presenters, you still feel that maybe, I mean, not to devalue them, but the skill, that there is incredible skill that presenters have of being able to keep sound on the air, avoid dead air, and in like not just avoid dead air, but like do it with great skill. But it has been interesting to me, particularly in the last year or so, learning the radio techniques of how the producers work and that sort of thing. But yeah, that said, still it's a bit unsure. Or
yeah, I think it's okay. I'm not going to rule it out. It's definitely something where I'm like, okay, that's like, you know, I draw a circle of my comfort zone. I'm like, oh, that's sitting on the outer border of that.
Yeah,
I just feel like I would just run out of stuff. I just like, well, thanks for joining us. I was still here after that 4 seconds of silence, you know.
You start reading out the stops on the Frankston line.
Yeah, who wants to hear something I did, you know, I did earlier? So yeah, I don't know. At the time of this conversation, presenting, etc., unknown. One of my siblings has done a bunch of presenting,
right?
And she's like mega extroverted.
Okay,
so I'm like, oh, maybe, yeah, it's a maybe.
right. And is this familiar for you? Have you been asked a guest on sessions or shows much?
A few times. Yeah. Usually, I think, and that's gone like in mixed ways. I did one once, which was just like, oh, you know, where like you want something scrubbed from the internet, and you can't even. It's an interview.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I do have some of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's out there somewhere. You won't find it, hopefully. I tried looking for it the other day to see, like, how easily can this be found? And I was like, okay, it can be found, but you'd have to go looking. Anyway, not good. And occasionally, like, I've been, like, you know, like, randomly roped into something. And actually, just recently... I offered my opinions and perspective on a radio show, but I'm anonymous, like as in I don't have a name. You'd have to know what I sound like.
Yeah.
Which granted, there are people who like it's,
yeah.
There are people who it's not so easy, but well, that wasn't me.
Like,
But it was a very funny subject matter where I was like, I'm going to stay anonymous on this one.
Right.
Yeah, so occasionally, but I don't think I'm like, I think I'd have to work on sort of, you know, talking in a wider variety of situations perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, to get more comfort in that kind of space. Right.
Yeah. And I think when I do it, it's out of like just having witnessed like what not to do. Like, you know, when you sort of work in broadcast and seeing guests come on that are just obviously really nervous and whatever. But if you're as like an audio operator and stuff, I can be like, well, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm not going to be that bad.
You collect up all the bad characters.
Yeah, like, so, you know, you just learn those things, like, don't talk off the microphone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you pick up those and ends up being hopefully okay.
Yeah, I did enjoy not having to do the microphone technique reminder today. But this one will not be scrubbed from the internet. But I want to thank you for joining us today, Nick.
Oh, thanks for having me.